I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Could you get around the world in 80 days without using a plane or a helicopter? I'll find out, plus see what can be eaten along this slow road. Tortillas are the daily bread of millions of people, but they also make a gorgeous canvas. I'll introduce you to a painter who creates art on tortillas. Plus, pig lard. I'll tell you why you should get yourself a slab and learn to love it. First, let's go to the farmer's market and see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, spring is coming to the farmer's markets. We have a lot of interesting spring vegetables here. I'm talking now with Odile, who works with the Fairview Gardens Farm at the Wednesday Market. And their stand is always beautifully arrayed with a wide variety of specialty crops. They're an urban farm in Goleta. They're totally surrounded by urban development. And today, Odile, let's talk about two things. You've got cherimoyas and you have white asparagus. So let's first talk about the white asparagus. It's very rare. You're the only farmer that brings it in. And I understand that it's very difficult to grow.
This is correct. We have to hide them from the sun. So we have to grow them in the dark. We have to make special mount for the asparagus to grow. As soon as they are exposed to the sun, they start to become green. So even when we bring them down here, we cannot just pile them up on the table because sunlight makes them green.
So what is it that makes a white asparagus so special? Is there a different flavor that you can tell?
I would say the flavor is amazing. It's very tender. It's usually not so woody as the green asparagus.
Good, good. Well, it really sounds mouth-watering. Can you tell us how much it costs? A bunch?
A bunch is half a pound and costs $3. It's $6 a pound.
Really? That's about the same as the green asparagus. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
It's a very great deal. I think people haven't found out yet.
That's an amazing deal. Okay, now let's talk about cherimoyas. And cherimoyas are a fairly rare crop. I think they're a semi-tropical or tropical. Why don't you describe what a cherimoya looks like?
Cherimoya are hard to describe. They have like these different angles. It's green, hard fruit, maybe big as a bigger orange. And they have like these geometrical looks to it. They are hard when you buy them, and they are like avocado that you have to let ripen at home. It's a great teacher of patience. You have to wait maybe a week or 10 days, and then they start to get brown, a little bit mushy, and inside they are white with huge black seeds, and they taste like a pineapple custard. It's like a pure dessert. It's very good.
Kind of a pineapple. That's the best description. It's white and creamy. You just scoop it out of the shell with a spoon, out of the skin. You wait till they get very soft, like a very ripe avocado, and just store them at room temperature. And you can tell they're ripe when they just get very, very soft to the touch. And then you just cut them or peel them and scoop them, and then just don't eat those big seeds, which are very easy to avoid because they're so big. All right, and then how much are the cherimoyas?
The cherimoyas are $4 a pound.
So how do you like to eat your cherimoyas? If you say you have a bunch of ripe cherimoyas and you can't eat them fast enough, what do you do?
Well, a good way to eat them is making smoothies, if you like that. You can make this custard cake, like raw food, with some almond base and then the cherimoya on top. It's very good.
That was Odile. She works with Fairview Gardens Organic Farm up in Goleta. It's a 100% organic farm that is completely surrounded by urban development, and it is a very famous and well-known and much-loved and treasured oasis in the middle of the urban desert that is most of California. We're visiting now with Josiah Citron, who is the chef owner of Melisse Restaurant and part owner of Lemon Moon, which is out there at Bundy and Olympic. And Josiah is a regular visitor to the market. In fact, he's here every single week. We're excited now that fava beans have started to show up at the market. And it's one of the things that a lot of chefs base their spring menu items on is these wonderful seasonal fava beans. So, Josiah, are you picking up some fava beans? And can you give us a recipe idea?
Yeah, we are. The first recipe we're going to be doing with them on the menu is that we're going to be doing a black bass that's cooked with the scales on, and it's served with a fresh fava bean puree that's crushed through the food mill. And then we serve that with some of the beautiful spring carrots, all the different colors that are coming out now. A little bit of chorizo, which, you know, bacon and just the fat really goes nice with the fava beans. It's always a great mix.
And the fava beans are the one that now they come in a very big, thick pod, and they have to be basically shelled twice, right?
It is a lot of work, and I think it's worth it. I mean, it's one of those great spring vegetables that come out, so we're always excited to have it.
What is it about the flavor? You say it goes well with meat. Can you describe
it? It's just got that really nice flavor. It's got a little earthiness, a little bit of starch, but not too much, and it's had a little sweetness at the end. It's not like hit you in the face sweet like a pea.
Let's describe the process of how you extricate these little beans from their pods.
Okay, so what we'll do is we'll take the fava beans, we'll take them out of the pod. And you want to make sure when you buy the pod that it's very green. And if you open them, you want to see a lot of cushion in there, a lot of, like a pillow. It's going to be really well protected, very green. You want them to be soft. They're not too hard or they get really starchy. And then you'll take them out of the first pod. Then you'll bring a salted water to a boil. You'll drop them in for about a minute and a half, 2 minutes. You'll take them out. You'll put them in ice water. And then from there, you'll take out the fava bean out of the secondary pod.
And is that just skin. You kind of cut it and pinch it and it
just
pops out?
Cut it with your fingernail and pinch it, the skin. And then we'll make a soup with it. So the soup is pretty simple once you have the fava beans. We'll sweat some onions, a little bit of leek. And then we'll put in a little bit of chicken stock or vegetable stock. Bring it to a boil. Cook it for like 20 minutes. Salt, pepper, and the savory, which you'll pick off the branches. You'll throw that in. And then you'll throw in the fava beans. Pop it all in a blender and blend it really well. Salt, pepper. And it's really good. And also it's nice if you're in the mood for it. You add some smoked bacon in the beginning with the onions. And with the fava bean, it's an incredible combination.
Yeah, and the fava beans, too, like you said, they should be very green and cushiony. And then during the season, as the season progresses, the beans actually get tougher and bigger and starchier. So you want to get them now in the spring. That was Josiah Citron. He is the chef and owner of Melisse Restaurant right here at Santa Monica at the corner of 11th and Wilshire. And he's got fava beans on his spring menu. And I guess they can use them in tons of different ways. And they're here at the markets now. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Around the world in 80 days. Can it be done without a plane? I'll find out as my next guest takes off on a journey to eat and experience the world the slow way. That's next on Good Food. Mark Schatzker, who we know for his great love of steak, is going to be traveling around the world the slow way. Here are his rules. He can take any form of transportation he chooses, as long as it's not a plane or a helicopter. And there's one catch. He must complete his circumnavigation of the globe in 80 days. Welcome to slow travel. We're going to be checking in with him occasionally since travel isn't fun without food. So where are you calling us from today?
I'm calling you from North Olmsted, Ohio. I started this morning in New York City, and here I am in North Olmsted.
Well, you're making some time.
It's not bad. I got to get to Chicago tonight.
So tell us a little bit about the idea of this trip. I know you're on the road doing a story for Condé Nast, and you lucky dog you don't have to stay in bargain basement places.
Yeah, that is really good because, you know, I actually did a bit of traveling around Europe when I was, you know, just after college kind of thing. And I didn't last very long because I thought it was such a crime to be visiting these great cities and not being able to afford to eat the food and not being able to afford to, not to say stay in the five-star places, but just stay in kind of an interesting hotel. So I guess I got really lucky because I'm sort of fulfilling the dream that I gave up on, you know, 15 years ago.
So what is your goal in terms of trying to explore slow travel? Why this idea that you can't take a plane or a helicopter to go around the globe?
It's not just an empty concept. It's not a stunt. The idea, if you think of the idea behind slow food is, you know, people talk about terroir, which is kind of the idea that you can taste geography. Well, this is sort of the same idea in that you experience the geography when you travel slowly. You know, when we all get in a plane, we take off, 5 hours later we land somewhere, and you can't even see down below, usually because of the clouds. So this is the idea that I'll see the land, experience the rises and falls in elevation, I'll taste the different cuisines and experience the different cultures as they slowly pass by.
So tell us what you've eaten today.
Today wasn't so good.
I could only imagine. Driving across the United States, it's very challenging.
It is. We stopped. You know, what I'm trying to do is avoid franchises because we all know what they're like and they are what they are and they're not my favorite thing. So we stopped in a town called Newton Falls, and there we found a restaurant called Robbie Lee's. There's only one Robbie Lee's, and there may be a good reason for that. You know, it's one of those tough things because the people there all seem to love it. It's a popular place, and everybody was really, really nice, but the food was quite bad. I mean, I had chili and grilled cheese sandwich, which on the surface, you know, could be great. I love chili. I love grilled cheese. But it just had a really kind of manufactured taste. Like the chili was, you know, you could taste the tomato soup. The grilled cheese had, the cheese was super, super processed. So it's the kind of food that isn't really made so much as assembled. And that's a little sad, I guess.
Are you going to be writing a blog as you do this?
I'm doing a blog, absolutely.
So if people want to read it, where can they find you?
It's at www.cntraveler.com/blogs/80days.
Great. Well, I'm sure we'll have a link on our website because we really look forward to checking in with you from time to time to see how you're doing.
Oh, and you know something? On the note of how the food is, it's not all a bad story because here in North Olmsted, unfortunately, I got here a bit too late to have lunch, but I did find a restaurant called Gourmet, and it's got an accent on the E. But they serve, I noticed, I walked in there looking for a payphone, and they had braised lamb shanks. They have fresh perch from Lake Erie. Not right now, but they do in the summer. And they get their cake sourced locally from a woman who makes cake. So there is interesting stuff going on. You just got to look hard.
We look forward to talking to you definitely when you hit the West Coast.
Great. Thanks so much, Evan.
We'll keep in touch with Mark Schatzker as he makes his way around the world in 80 days. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find a link to his blog and see where he is right now. Mark's a Toronto-based food writer and contributor to Condé Nast Traveler and Slate.com. We'll see if Mark ends up in Australia. He could eat bush food there. The native Australian foods from the outback have sustained the Australian Aborigines for around 60,000 years. I'll be back with a pair of Aussie food show hosts who are bringing in some of these exotic ingredients to the U.S. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Indigenous of America have become a part of the modern American table. Wild rice, salmon, squash, blueberries. We recognize them as delicious examples of what were once wild foods. But what about the continent down under? What is Aboriginal food or bush tucker? Vic Cherikoff and Benjamin Christie are co-hosts of an Australian cooking show called Dining Down Under, which uses Indigenous Australian ingredients known as bush food, food from the outback. I wonder if blooming onions are an Aboriginal food. We'll have to ask. Welcome, both of you.
G'day.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
And what are you blooming talking about?
Evan, blooming onions are a fiction. They're a concoction of the Outback Steakhouse, and you get nothing Australian there at this stage. We're working on changing it, but Vic Cherikoff is my name, and I've been working on the nutritional value of native Australian foods for quite some time. In fact, it's taken a couple of decades to get to the stage where I've been able to commercialise a range of indigenous Australian flavours. And it's interesting that, you know, the whole globe was explored and colonised and really being driven by trade and by the exploration of spices. And somehow they totally circumvented Australia, and so it's sort of befallen to myself and Benjamin to introduce these flavours to the world, which is what we're doing with Dining Down Under.
So did colonial settlers recognise the value of bush food immediately, or was it too weird?
Hey, we were colonised by the English, and their food traditions at the time were killing them at the age of about 30 to 35. And, you know, they even brought herds of animals. They basically ate literally brined meat and peas.
Now, let's talk about these foods. What are bush foods? What are some of the Aboriginal foods that you're playing with now?
Well, we don't call them bush foods as such anymore. I mean, they've been taken out of the bush. They're now grown in organic plantations. Things like rye berries, Illawarra plums, Davidson plums, Kakadu plums. The Kakadu plums, the world's highest vitamin C fruit. Some of the herbs that are now coming into quite voluminous production are things like lemon myrtle. And that's now more commonly used as a lemon myrtle sprinkle, which has wild lime and lemon aspen dried and put back into it and is a blend of a couple of different herbs. Alpine pepper is a mix of the leaves, the berries, extracts, and a number of herbs that effectively support pepper.
Describe what the actual flavors are of these things. Do they tend to be sharp? Do they tend to be deeply pungent? Are they earthy? Are they lemony?
The pepper has a woody note to it. This is alpine pepper, just to describe the flavour there. It has a woody note with a fruity character, and the pungency is a slow-onset back-of-the-throat burn that beautifully complements black and white pepper and even chilli. It supports it.
Yeah, taking that further, lemon myrtle is very aromatic. It has strong citrusy flavours, and it's great with... In things like prawns and seafood, just to give them that sort of lemony note, like a verbena. And one of the things, an overall sort of look at the native flavours, is that they're not like the Mediterranean herbs as such, that you can use them in a very versatile way. The use of the native herbs are towards the end of the cooking cycle. So something like lemon myrtle is high in essential oils. So if you were to boil it or put a lot of heat under it, the flavour dissipates into the kitchen. You have a great smelling kitchen, but you have no flavour and just have greenery in your dish.
I mean, wattle seed is something that's pretty commonly known now in the US.
What is it?
It's an acacia seed. Acacias, a lot of people know with their little yellow blossomy flowers. And I accidentally over-roasted some wattle seed and turned it into this flavouring by accident. And the flavour profile there is coffee, chocolate and hazelnut.
Wow. So are they tiny, like the size of a poppy seed, for example?
It looks like a ground coffee. And it's either as a powder, as a liquid extract, and we're just about to launch a wattle seed paste. And that's largely for the gelato market, an ice cream market. But you could take a little bit of this paste and put it into a cream sauce for mushrooms, and it's just wonderful to give you a really nice savory flavor.
Let's talk for a minute, of course, about kangaroo. Kangaroo ranched, or are they still only hunted?
No, they're only still hunted. There's an often misdemeanor with kangaroo. There's so many of them out there now, and it's they're shot, they're taken to the abattoir straight away. They're cleaned and they're packaged within 12 hours. They're wild caught. The flavour can vary between animals, so there's no real consistent flavour as such. It's very much like venison or bison. Same sort of flavours.
We basically in Australia, being largely pastoral out in the bush, the vegetation was cleared in terms of improving pastures and water made more available for cattle. What that did is absolutely explode the population of kangaroos. The reason we can't farm them or ranch them is that they are still inherently wild animals, and they die of shock if you try and round them up in any way.
What is the texture of the meat like, and how is it generally prepared?
The meat's fantastic. The meat's actually very lean. A good chef could actually take a piece of kangaroo meat. You could prepare that so it would taste exactly like beef.
What about grubs in the kitchen? I think when many of us think about Aboriginal foods, we definitely think about witchetty grubs.
Witchetty grubs were popular back in restaurants about 10 years ago. About 7 years ago, we started a drought down under, and these days you just can't get witchetty grubs. The forest, the outback is dry, and there's just the grubs are not growing in the abundance that they used to. So I mean, you won't even see witchetty grubs available. In fact, a couple of months ago, I got a request from someone in the government in Japan who was coming down under, and they wanted to find some witchetty grubs in a restaurant. And both Vic and I tried sort of desperately to try and find some through growers and things like that, and we just couldn't even find half a dozen. So, yeah, you won't find them.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, Vic and Benjamin, for taking the time to spend with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Evan.
Vic Cherikov and Benjamin Christie are co-hosts of an Australian cooking show called Dining Down Under. You can find some of these Outback products under the Vic Cherikov brand name at Surface in Culver City. Go to our website to find out more about them at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of exotic ingredients, what do you think of when I say the phrase pig lard? Do you think of heart attacks and wrinkle your face in disgust? Well, pig lard was America's first fat. There's no trans fat in pig lard, and it's lower in saturated fat than butter. I'll get you excited for lard again. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Just the word sends shivers up my spine. Not because it grosses me out, but because things made with lard taste so good. I've always had the suspicion that lard was unfairly a target, made out to be a totally evil ingredient, while we're told that we could eat man-made fats with impunity. Well, things change, don't they? And with trans fats being recognized for what they are, really bad and totally unnatural, some chefs are turning back to lard with big smiles on their faces. And one of the reasons is that we can get such beautiful quality lard from small farmers like Jennifer Small, who has Flying Pigs Farm and raises some pretty great pigs. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
What exactly is lard?
Lard is fat from a pig. And there are different types of fats or different types of lard from the same pig. So there is fat back, which is, of course, the fat along the back of the pig. It's smooth and shiny, and it comes in big sheets. It lays just underneath the skin of a pig. There's also caul fat, which is a lacy fat, very hard to come by, and it essentially holds the intestines and other innards together. Finally, there's leaf lard, which is a crumbly, dry, lumpy, bumpy fat found near the kidneys.
Leaf lard is the lard that one hears about as being so fabulous for baking.
Absolutely. I first read about leaf lard in 2000 when we had our first pigs, and I became very interested in it, and we began saving it and freezing it for our customers at that time and selling it frozen. I made my first leaf lard pie crust, I think about that time. I usually made pie crust out of Crisco, like most of us did. And when I started making it out of a combination of butter and leaf lard, I was really taken aback, actually, at what high-quality pastry you can produce out of leaf lard. It's really extraordinary. It's sort of the difference between a tomato in January and one grown in August. It's that different.
Can leaf lard be used just as it comes from the animal, chopped up, or does it have to be rendered?
No, leaf lard does have to be rendered. When you take fat like leaf lard right out of the animal, there are bits of tissue in it. There's bits of maybe even bits of blood in it. And lard, like all fats, butter too, contains a little bit of water, and you want to get rid of that tiny bit of water.
So describe the process of rendering for us.
Rendering is one of those things that's almost like making chicken stock. It's very simple, but it's time-consuming, so you only want to do it once or twice a year. I set aside a Sunday afternoon for 3 hours or so. The lard is chopped into small bits or run through a meat grinder. And then you put it into a shallow pan, add a little bit of water so that it doesn't scorch in the beginning stages, and you heat it slowly at about 250 degrees. And once that's occurred for a couple hours and the fat is all melted, then you simply pour it through cheesecloth. And I freeze mine after pouring it through the cheesecloth in muffin tins or ice cube trays. Then once it's frozen, I just pop it into a Ziploc bag and keep it in my freezer. That way I can pull out just a few tablespoons at a time when I need to use it.
In the process of rendering, there's some little bits that are left behind that are called cracklings.
Those are delicious.
Yes, they are.
When I strain those out and put them on a paper towel when I'm working in my kitchen, you know, it's hard not to snack on those. You can freeze them for a little while, and sometimes I'll add them to cornbread. I might even sprinkle them on top of a salad, like bacon bits, or put them into maybe a pot of beans cooking on the stove. Those are very, very good.
You know, I should say right off that the kind of lard we're talking about, compared to the kind of lard that one sees in the grocery store packed in blocks in the red box, it's like apples and oranges.
The lard in the supermarket in those one-pound squares is usually almost always hydrogenated lard. And that sort of lard contains exactly the trans fats I think most of us are now trying to avoid.
Talk to us a little bit about sort of the nutrition things about lard.
Lard contains, and we're talking about not the hydrogenated lard, lard contains 40% saturated fat. And this compares with about 60% saturated fat in butter. Lard's level of monounsaturated fat, the good fat, is 45%. And that compares with 23% in butter. So that gives you an idea that lard is not as scary a thing as people once thought.
So who are the people that are using your lard these days? Do a lot of chefs make pilgrimages to the farm or to your website?
To our website and also to our farmer's market stand in New York City at Green Markets. We do have chefs who come and pick up loads of back fat, the big thick sheets. They use it to make their own lardo.
Now, we should talk about what lardo is, because a lot of people who have heard about lardo, which is an Italian charcuterie, think of it as lard, like a rendered lard. But in fact, it is not that.
No, not at all. Lardo was, again, this goes back to when people used every bit of the pig, and especially the poor. They needed that fat for energy all the time. And the story of lardo, I believe, goes back to when the marble quarry workers in Italy would take a piece of back fat and pack it into a shallow hole in the marble and essentially leave it there for 6 months, I believe, with herbs or salt.
Yeah, with herbs and salt. And it's cured, much like prosciutto is cured, except there's no meat, just the fat. It is one of the truly incredible foods of the world, I must say.
You know, Matt and Ted Lee wrote a few years ago something that I always think is funny. They wrote, "Most Americans would sooner smoke unfiltered camels while riding a motorcycle without a helmet than eat lard."
That's true. And how sad is that? Thank you, Jennifer. This has been wonderful fun talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Small and her husband Michael Yezzi run Flying Pig Farms. I've got a link to their site on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can buy the lard and render it yourself at home. Lard definitely helps make delicious tortillas. And tortillas can be used for many things, including as a canvas for a painter. Bet you didn't think about that one. Juan Angelino turned his love of tortillas into the base for his art. That's coming up in 1 minute, right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Favorite foods is the tortilla. Artist Joe Bravo uses the tortilla as a unique and powerful artistic medium. I guess my first question would be,
What made you think about doing this? Was it sort of an economy move? Did you run out of canvas and you just...
That's it. And I was in college, speaking of running out of canvas and being a student. I had brushes and I had paints, but I didn't have money for canvas. Even canvas was expensive back then. So I had a small corn tortilla and I thought, well, you know, why not paint on it? And the professor loved it and I forgot about it.
Yeah. And then you resurrected it.
Right. About 7 years ago, I was talking to an alumni, and she said, remember the tortilla artist from college? I said, yeah, that was me. And she says, what a great idea, you know, both socially, politically, just on all levels. So I started thinking about it, researching different varnishes. Reason the other ones, I forgot about them because they broke. You know, I didn't really preserve them.
So once you finish these, I have one here, and they actually feel a little leathery. They're not brittle.
No, because with the acrylic varnish that I use, I put several coats. I'm essentially encasing the tortilla in plastic, so it becomes flexible. I have a tortilleria in East L.A., San Marcos Tortilleria, who makes my tortillas especially for me. That's why they're so big.
I was going to comment on that because these aren't even the burrito size that you see in the store. No, these are huge. How big are they?
When I get them, they're anywhere from 25 to 28 inches in diameter, but they shrink about 3 or 4 inches once I dry them. And I get them just like regular store-bought tortillas. They're plain white.
And so they're plain white. And so you're the one that gives them their characteristic little
right.
bubbling burn marks.
Right.
How do you do that?
Just over my stovetop, I get two burners going. And I take the grill part off because I don't want to, you know, I also cook food out there. So I take the grill off and just over an open flame, I burnt them, I turn them around, and I kind of play with them, you know, flip them, and it's, you know, kind of like a blacksmith. And I do several at once, and then I varnish them.
So you varnish them even before you start using the acrylics to paint?
Right. Once I get the burnt marks on there, then I start.
Does the pattern of the burn marks inspire you at all in terms of how the design is going to lay out on the tortilla?
Sure. After I have a glass of wine, I look at it. I go, oh, that looks... That looks like, you know, the Virgen of Guadalupe, or that looks like a jaguar. In fact, I have one of a jaguar where the burnt marks looks like the fur of a jaguar. And that's, I go, oh, that looks like a jaguar. So I paint a jaguar.
So the glass of wine is an integral part of the process.
Sometimes. But only one.
How do you get inspired as to the subject matter that you're going to use on the tortillas? Do you try and keep the subject matter something that relates to the culture of the tortilla?
Yes, but I do it in a tongue-in-cheek way. And some of them, are serious. I have one piece where it's a bull and the horns are chilies, and I call it chili con carne. And the bull is the carne, the meat. I have a really nice illustration of a pit bull, kind of like a wide angle view with a big head, and that's called Bite Me. So here again, that's a tie-in to the tortilla. And one of them, I have this woman where the tortilla is the actual sombrero.
I saw that one. That's quite beautiful. Now, I understand that you received a pretty great honor from the Food Network.
Yes, I went to the Food Network's their first time ever awards in South Beach, Miami, and I was nominated for a food art award, but I still try to do oil painting or pastels or other types of art so I don't get branded as a tortilla artist, which is okay. You know, if it opens doors for other things, that's okay. But
I mean, you were one of the original muralists. Down in East L.A.
Yes, I used to do murals, and I kind of got away. I had sons, so I started working for...
Do any of them love to paint?
They're not artists, but I think it skips a generation, so I'm waiting for the grandkids.
If we were interested in purchasing a tortilla, are they super expensive?
They start at around $1,500, and it's, you know, which is comparable to any good canvas painting, but this is a very involved process. It takes me a few weeks.
So let's describe a little bit of this particular tortilla piece in front of me. Talk to me about her.
Okay, this is a little Mexican girl, but she's got the big eyes, a very anime-inspired type feel to it.
Yeah, she's great. She has a rose tucked behind her ear and a little gold earring and these beautiful dark braids, and she has these little ribbons in her hair of the three colors of the Mexican flag and her little spiky hairdo. She's great.
Yeah.
She's like modern on something really ancient.
Yeah, I like to juxtapose styles. I like to juxtapose tradition with contemporary art and just mix it all up.
How do you recommend framing these?
I have custom frames, shadow box frames made for me. And usually they're anywhere from 28 inches to 4 feet.
Wow.
I did a large Aztec calendar, but I piece about 5 of them together, but you can't tell. It's, you know, different tortillas, and that's also at the gallery.
Well, I can't wait to see that one. Can you tell us where your exhibit is?
It's at the Mexican Cultural Institute. It's on Alvera Street, 125 Paseo de la Plaza. It's right across from the bandstand. The exhibit will run through April 22nd, and I'm usually there on weekends between 1 and 5, so if you want to come by and talk about the art, you know, I'll be more than happy to.
That is so great, Joe. I'm so happy to have met you. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
That was artist Joe Bravo. He uses his artistic talent to paint on very, very large tortillas. If you're interested in seeing his work, we'll have a link to his website and also information about the art exhibit he's having right now in Alvera Street. Not every great kitchen can be found in a restaurant. The best are often in the homes belonging to a grandmother or a mom. There's a series on NPR that's been documenting these hidden kitchens. I'll talk next with one of the producers of this series about the hidden kitchens of Los Angeles. That's next. Stay tuned to Good Food on KCRW. Best kitchens you remember. Were they the five-star variety you read about or maybe you've been lucky enough to eat in? Or are they more, shall we say, hidden? Maybe a kitchen on wheels that appears in the middle of the night and disappears by morning. Davia Nelson and Nikki Silver are the Kitchen Sisters. They explore the world of hidden kitchens, and Davia Nelson's with us this morning. Tell us what hidden kitchens are.
Hidden kitchens are the places people are cooking that aren't so obvious, that are tucked away down alleyways or by the side of the road or a church supper or a fish fry. There are all the ways communities come together through food in sort of unofficial places.
And could you share a story with us of a hidden kitchen that you've discovered pretty recently that really stuck with you somehow?
This is sort of an odd one. It's sort of a fleeting one. I was just flying from San Francisco to the Burbank Airport about a week ago, and I was renting a car from Avis. It was about 8:30 at night, and all of a sudden I started noticing this sort of flurry of activity among all the workers at the desks. It's just one continuous table, Dollar, National, Avis, Hertz, etc. And these little Tupperware dishes were suddenly being spirited across the desks, and people were walking in from outside with these steaming plates. And all of a sudden, I just started asking the guys there about their food, and they started showing me that Dollar has the refrigerator, and Avis has the microwave, and someone else has some little setup tucked away somewhere outside in a parking lot, and they kind of cook for each other. Mel over at Avis, who's from the Philippines, is kind of in charge of it. His specialty is Chinese. And they kind of all stand at their desks. There's no real official place for them to go eat, but there's this sort of communal rent-a-car meal that happens at the Burbank Airport. And then they started telling me, I said, so do you guys cook together every day? Well, no, not every day, but sometimes the restaurants at the Burbank Airport cook for the rent-a-car guys, and they go in through the airport, through security, and they have a meal together at the restaurant, you know, in shifts because they have to keep the desks watched. And then they told me about how there's construction going on at the Burbank Airport, and the construction crew blew it, and they lost all their electricity and computers for a day. And the Burbank Airport, in order to make it up to all the rental car people, gave them a banquet upstairs at the Burbank Airport.
That's so funny, because it's sort of like they had this rep of being really involved with their food. So management thought, well, we can smooth it over with them by just giving them more good food.
More good food. They appreciate it. And then I was going back to return the Avis rent-a-car, this time to the L.A. airport, and the big shuttle bus was full of people, and I was getting off at United, which is, most people know, it's the last stop. And I noticed that the driver sounded like he was from the Caribbean somewhere, kind of, I thought, the Trinidad. And anyway, I was the last person on the bus. I was at the back of the bus, and I just yelled up to him, well, now we're alone. Now we can sing. And we just started talking about Trinidadian music. So then we started talking about Trinidadian food, and he started telling me about a place when this great food, Bus Up Shut. Do you know Bus Up Shut?
No.
Bus Up Shut is made with this kind of roti. It's roti being sort of a like a Indian and Caribbean tortilla almost, that they do these beautiful wrapped burrito-like dishes. Bus Up Shut means burst open shirt. You see it on menus at little shops, little go shops in Trinidad. He told me about the Caribbean Tree. Do you know that place?
No.
It's got a tree growing up in the middle of it. It's in Inglewood. And he said they have the greatest Trinidadian music there on Friday nights. And the Kitchen Sisters, we do the Hidden Kitchen series, but we also do a series called Lost and Found Sound. And one of the stories we did was in Trinidad about the Trinidad Tripoli Steel Band, and how Liberace discovered this pan band in the 60s and took them on tour with him through all of America, including the very segregationist South in the 60s, 27 black men and Liberace playing the South.
Unbelievable.
One of the pan band members is who has this great place, the Caribbean Tree. So Avis was just a motherlode for me recently of Hidden Kitchens.
But that never would have happened if you hadn't said, now we're alone, we can sing.
Yeah, he thought I was insane. And then, okay, here's the other tie-in to that. I travel for our stories so much, and people in L.A. probably have noticed this too. If you check in your luggage with the Skycaps at United, you are in, oftentimes, Jamaica. I mean, it is a Jamaican crew. The head of the crew, who I met after years of checking in luggage and carrying sound equipment and always having too many bags, and finally over the years we just started talking to one another a little more, was a guy named Beef. Beef is from Jamaica. And one day I said, so why do they call you Beef? And he said, because women like the way I smell. So it's food. It's just everywhere.
Davia, as always, it has been just a mega pleasure, and we're so happy you're going to be in town with Nikki.
Thank you.
Davia Nelson is the co-producer, along with Nikki Silva, of Hidden Kitchens. These accomplished NPR producers will be live at the Hammer Museum on March 29th. To find out how to see them, go to our website at kcrw.com/goodfood for a link to the event. Some food stays hidden because of catastrophe or disaster. A large event in Central California could potentially wipe out many varieties of food species that we depend on. In order to preserve the world's food supply, an international community has established a seed vault in a protected part of the world. More on the Fort Knox of seeds when Good Food returns. People talk about crop diversity. Do you really understand what it means? And do seed savers sound like a bunch of elderly women who keep their favorite tomato seeds in a sock drawer? Well, actually, seed saving for crop diversity is a vital job. So vital a job that a doomsday seed vault is being built on a remote Norwegian island near the North Pole. Carrie Fowler is the executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, the organization which will be collecting and maintaining the seed collection. So when we talk about world crop diversity, what exactly does that mean and why is it so important?
There's a gigantic amount of crop diversity. Most people don't see it, but it underpins the agricultural system in the world. There are well over 100,000 different varieties of rice and thousands of varieties of potatoes and tomatoes and all of the other crops that we depend on. And the crops themselves depend on this diversity to help them adapt and evolve to new conditions such as climate change.
All of these hundreds of thousands of varieties of different food crops, they're all differently adapted depending upon where in the world they're being grown, correct?
That's right.
So when something happens, like the tsunami, for example, what happens to the food crops in those areas where everything's wiped out, not only crops that are currently growing, but sources of seeds that were going to be saved for future crops?
Well, we tend to think of extinction as something that happens only to dinosaurs or maybe threatens big animals like whales. But actually, the different crop varieties can also become extinct. And when a particular variety becomes extinct, we can lose the genes, the natural qualities, the characteristics of that particular variety. And potentially, those are characteristics that we're really going to need or just want to have in the future. So one of the greatest mass extinctions on Earth has actually been taking place quite quietly during our lifetime, and this is the extinction of many of the crop varieties upon which agriculture is built.
What is the role of a seed bank?
It's a two-part role. One is a conservation role. A seed bank is really just a fancy word for a refrigerator or freezer where seeds are kept for a long time and can be accessed by breeders or researchers. But the real purpose of a seed bank is to serve those plant breeders and researchers. This is where a plant breeder who wants to breed a new variety of wheat or corn or broccoli or whatever that's more pest or disease resistant or maybe drought tolerant is going to go back into the seed bank and find old varieties that have those kind of characteristics and try to breed a new variety that will incorporate them. So it's, in a way, the raw material for the future of agriculture.
So the seed banks that are out there currently, do they tend to be international in scope? Do they take seeds from all over the world's different agricultures and put them in one place? Or are most current seed banks nationally oriented?
They're mostly national, and most of the national seed banks will contain material primarily from those countries. But at the same time, I could say that most seed banks have imported a lot of material from elsewhere. This is certainly the case for the seed bank in the United States because there are only a few crops, sunflowers, Jerusalem artichokes, hops, and a few berries, that are actually native to the United States. So the United States has one of the biggest and best seed banks in the world.
Let's talk for a minute about this, quote, doomsday seed vault. What makes it different from the other seed banks that we've been talking about?
It's the safety net for the other seed banks. If something goes wrong with one of the other seed banks, this is what will rescue that seed bank and potentially the agricultural system in that country. We've had a number of disasters, shall we say, in the last couple of years that have actually destroyed national seed banks. Just back in September, a typhoon went through the Philippines and did a lot of damage to the seed bank in the Philippines. The seed banks in Afghanistan and Iraq have been destroyed recently for reasons you can guess. These are real tragedies, and when the biological diversity in those seed banks is lost, it's lost forever.
Now, once a seed goes into the vault, does it just stay there sort of inactive waiting, or do the seeds occasionally have to be grown out to freshen them and then rotated with new seeds from that grown-out plant?
It's the latter. The seed vault is not a time capsule that we're going to seal up and walk away from. It's really a living institution. At a certain point, you need to take seeds out, grow them into a real plant, harvest new seeds, put that back in. But, of course, many varieties can be stored quite happily in these frozen conditions for decades, if not hundreds of years.
Wow. Thank you very much, Carrie.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Carrie Fowler is the executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust in Rome. There are other secretive things in our food supply besides a hidden vault of seeds. It's the ingredients hidden in food labels in the grocery store. Next, why you feel comfortable paying $2 for filtered tap water and other such surprises in grocery store aisles. That's coming up next on Good Food. One of our guests that American food labels don't need to list 100% of their ingredients. Once you know that, well, you start to wonder all the other label intricacies that might lead you to believe one thing when the reality is quite another. What you might think of as information to make a good nutritional choice might just be very clever marketing. Kimberly Lord-Stewart is the author of Eating Between the Lines, the Supermarket Shopper's Guide to the Truth Behind Food Labels. She's also editor-in-chief of Dining Out magazine and regularly contributes to numerous publications such as Alternative Health, Better Nutrition, Eating Well, and Vegetarian Times. I'm so glad to have you here because this label thing has really been on all of our minds.
I think we all enter the grocery store with an empty cart full of really good expectations, and by the time we get to aisle 3 or 4, we feel like we need to be a PhD just to figure out what's in our food.
Let's address this conundrum that we here on Good Food recently found out. Is it really true that manufacturers don't have to list 100% of the ingredients on their labels?
It is true, particularly for spices. So when you look at MSG, gluten, some of the items that many of your listeners may be sensitive to, if those components are small enough, they will not be listed on the ingredient panel. They'll be listed sort of arbitrarily as spices.
Wow. And I always thought spices just meant like salt and pepper.
Exactly. No.
What do you think is the single most important label issue we can learn?
I think right now trans fats are in the news. We're seeing legislation in various states deciding whether to allow trans fats in restaurant food. In 2006, food manufacturers were required to label trans fats on their products. But as with most labeling rules, there was a loophole. And this allowed for manufacturers to list their products as trans fat free, even if they contained 0.5 gram of trans fats per serving or less.
We all know that basically a serving is a bag. So even if it says you have a bag of, let's say, a bag of potato chips, and it says 4.5 servings, most people are going to eat the bag.
Exactly. Let's say you rip through that whole bag, or you eat a series of different products throughout the day that are all, quote unquote, trans fat free. You're going to eat more than you thought you might be eating. The reason trans fats are something we need to pay attention to is our body recognizes saturated fats and unsaturated fats really easily, and it knows what to do with those fats. Trans fats are this hybrid between those two. And when our body, when we ingest them, our body looks at those and says, I'm not sure what to do with them. And that fat gets stored around our organs and around our abdomen, which we know leads to heart disease and can lead to diabetes as well.
If there are these nutritional guidelines that the USDA sets up that we're supposed to follow, why are there then loopholes in the way things are labeled that make it harder for us to follow those guidelines?
It's a combination of a lot of different factors. Most of it is from industry pressure. Most of it is food manufacturers saying, wait a minute, we can't find enough ingredients within this period of time to switch to that are trans fat free.
Enough ingredients that are cheap enough for us to make a
exactly.
profit.
Exactly. There you go.
One of the most fascinating things I think I read about in your book was just about water, specifically bottled water. What is our misunderstanding of what is inside the bottle?
It is perfectly okay for water manufacturers to bottle tap water because that water goes through a certain purifying process, and that's acceptable to the U.S. government. It's acceptable to run out of your tap. It's acceptable to put in a bottle. So about 25% of bottled water on the shelf is tap water. So you may be paying for someone else's tap water. It may taste a little different than your water for a couple of reasons. They may use ultraviolet light or purification processes that your city doesn't use. So the water may taste a little different, but it's really no different than tap water.
Kimberly just pointed to a bottle of Aquafina that I have here, which is like the poster child for this kind of water.
Aquafina is purified drinking water. All city tap water can make that very same claim, purified drinking water. So most likely you've paid for somebody else's tap water by buying this brand.
Can't we just make our water taste better by buying a water filter?
Yes. Buy a water filter for your taps, buy a water filter for your home. You're going to get the same purification process that's used in bottled water, and you're going to save an awful lot of money and an awful lot of oil.
Now, what is the oil connection with bottled water?
Just to manufacture the amount of plastics that we put out to bottle this water uses up 1.5 million barrels of oil per year.
That's just insane.
Wow.
I have to say that last night I was watching television and a commercial came on for a popular soda. And it was amazing. The soda was portrayed as, quote, natural. It was being shown in like farmers market baskets like it was a bushel of citrus fruits. And it was being picked out of the ground and being held up as if it were braids of garlic. And I just thought to myself, this is evil.
It is.
Tell us a little bit about soda.
Natural is probably one of the most overused words in the grocery store. We interpret that to mean out of the earth, to be something that's pure. Natural sodas simply have all of the additives, preservatives, and colors removed. It doesn't mean that they aren't high in sugar. A 12-ounce can of soda, whether it's a natural brand, say from a health food store or from a conventional grocer, how much sugar would you say is in that or sweetener?
2 to 4 tablespoons.
Okay, we're looking at 9 teaspoons, which is about 3 tablespoons
wow.
of sweetener in that 12-ounce soda.
So that's like the same amount of sugar that you would use to make a batch of cookies.
Exactly, or a cake.
Are they allowed to say natural sometimes because the flavorings are natural? Like maybe they're actually using essential oils of a citrus?
Yes. But natural is such a vague term that it really only means there's no additives, preservatives, or artificial flavors or colorings. It has nothing to do with health.
Kimberly, we're definitely going to have you back and continue our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Kimberly Lord Stewart. She's the author of Eating Between the Lines, The Supermarket Shopper's Guide to the Truth Behind Food Labels. You can find out all the info from today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Subscribe to the Good Food audio and video podcast there also. You can see our videos on YouTube. Just search KCRW's Good Food. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Chaloner, with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Carson. Special thanks to music supervisor Gary Masiha and to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week.